Thank you for listening to a reading presented by the Poetry Center of Chicago. The Poetry Center is an independent, nonprofit arts organization promoting poetry in Chicago through readings, workshops, and arts education. To learn more about the Poetry Center, to read poems by our students in Chicago Public Schools, or to donate, please visit www.poetrycenter.org.
I want to say a message that I want to get out, something that's very conscious that I want to say. Poetry to me is like a pebble in the shoe. You know, it's there and it hurts and you better get it out. And you have to write it. It's not a choice and I must find what it is.
Sandra Cisneros, Chicago-born author of two collections of short stories, The House on Mongo Street and Woman Hollering Creek, and a volume of poems titled My Wicked, Wicked Ways. Critical response to her work has been enthusiastic. The New York Times Book Review wrote that Ms. Cisneros seduces with precise, fair prose and creates unforgettable characters we want to lift off the page. She's not only a gifted writer, but an absolutely essential one. And the Washington Post Book World wrote, Sandra Cisneros knows both that the heart can be broken and that it can rise and soar like a bird. Whatever story she chooses to tell, we should be listening for a long time to come. The Poetry Center of Chicago presented a reading by Sandra Cisneros last December 16th at the Art Institute Auditorium, and WFMT was there to record it. Here is Sandra Cisneros.
All right, I'm going to start with the request from Diana Solis, which is the Christmas story, called Three Wise Guys. Un cuento de Navidad, a Christmas story. And then I'm going to switch into poems, some old poems, and I'm going to come all the way up to the brand new ones that I've been throwing under the bed. You know? But I realized my mother was going to be here, so I'm not going to read all of the ones I thought I was going to read. You have to go to San Francisco to hear those. Anyway, Three Wise Guys. Un cuento de Navidad, a Christmas story. The big box came marked, "Do not open till Christmas." But the mama said, "Not until the day of the three kings. Not until Dia de los Reyes, the 6th of January. Do you hear?" That is what the mama said exactly, only she said it all in Spanish. Because in Mexico, where she was raised, it is the custom for boys and girls to receive their presents on January 6th and not Christmas, even though they were living on the Texas side of the river now. Not until the 6th of January. Yesterday, the mama had risen in the dark, same as always, to reheat the coffee in a tin saucepan and warm the breakfast tortillas. The papa had gotten up coughing and spitting up the night, complaining how the evening before the buzzing of the chicharras had kept him from sleeping. By the time the mama had the house smelling of cinnamon and oatmeal, the papa would be gone to the fields, the sun already tangled in the trees and the urraca screeching their rubber screech cry. The boy Ruben and the girl Rosalinda would have to be shaken awake for school. The mama would give the baby Gilberto his bottle, and then she would go back to sleep before getting up again to the chores that were always waiting. That is how the world had been. But today the big box had arrived. When the boy Ruben and the girl Rosalinda came home from school, it was already sitting in the living room in front of the television set that no longer worked. Who had put it there? Where had it come from? A box covered with red paper with green Christmas trees and a card on top that said, "Merry Christmas to the Gonzalez family. Frank, Earl, and Dwight Travis. P.S. Do not open till Christmas." That's all. Two times the mama was made to come into the living room, first to explain to the children and later to their father how the brothers Travis had arrived in the blue pickup and how it had taken all three of those big men to lift the box off the back of the truck and bring it inside and how she had had to nod and say thank you, thank you, thank you over and over because those were the only words she knew in English. Then the brothers Travis had nodded as well, the way they always did when they came and brought the boxes of clothes or the turkey each November or the canned ham on Easter, ever since the children had begun to earn high grades at the school where Dwight Travis was the principal. But this year, The Christmas box was bigger than usual. What could be in a box so big? The boy Ruben and the girl Rosalinda begged all afternoon to be allowed to open it. And that is when the mama had said, the 6th of January, the day of the three kings, not a day sooner. It seemed the weeks stretched themselves wider and wider since the arrival of the big box. The mama got used to sweeping around it because it was too heavy for her to push in a corner. But since the television no longer worked, ever since the afternoon the children had poured iced tea through the little grates in the back, it really didn't matter if it obstructed the view. Visitors that came inside the house were told and told again the story of how the box had arrived, and then each was made to guess what was inside. It was the Comadre Elodia who suggested over coffee one afternoon that the big box held a portable washing machine that could be rolled away when not in use, the kind she had seen in her Sears Roebuck catalog. The mama said she hoped so, because the Ringer washer she had used for the last 10 years had finally gotten tired and quit. These past few weeks, she had had to boil all the clothes in the big pot she used for cooking the Christmas tamales. Yes, she hoped the big box was a portable washing machine. A portable washing machine, even a portable one, that would be good. But the neighbor man Cayetano said, "What foolishness, comadre! Can't you see the box is too small to hold a washing machine, even a portable one? Most likely God has heard your prayers and sent a new color TV. With a good antenna, you could catch all the Mexican soap operas," the neighbor man said. "You could distract yourself with the complicated troubles of the rich and then give thanks to God for the blessed simplicity of your poverty. A new TV would surely be the end to all your miseries." Each night, when the papa came home from the fields, he would spread newspapers on the cot in the living room where the boy Ruben and the girl Rosalinda slept, and sit facing the big box in the center of the room. Each night, he imagined the box held something different. The day before yesterday, he guessed a new record player. Yesterday, an ice chest filled with beer. Today, the papa sat with his bottle of beer, fanning himself with a magazine, and said in a voice as much a plea as a prophecy, "Air conditioner." But the boy Ruben and the girl Rosalinda were sure the big box was filled with toys. They had even punctured a hole in one corner with a pencil when their mother was busy cooking, although they could see nothing inside but blackness. Only the baby Gilberto remained uninterested in the contents of the big box and seemed each day more fascinated with the exterior of the box rather than the interior. One afternoon, he tore off a fistful of paper, which he was chewing, when his mother swooped him up with one arm, rushed him to the kitchen sink, and forced him to swallow handfuls of lukewarm water in case the red dye of the wrapping paper might be poisonous. When Christmas Eve finally came, the family Gonzalez put on their good clothes and went to midnight mass. They came home to a house that smelled of tamales and atole, and everyone was allowed to open one present before going to sleep, but the big box was to remain untouched until the 6th of January. On New Year's Eve, the little house was filled with people, some related, some not, coming in and out. The friends of the papa came with bottles, and the mama set out a bowl of grapes to count off the new year. That night, the children did not sleep in the living room cot as they usually did, because the living room was crowded with big fannied ladies and fat-stomached men sashaying to the accordion music of the midget twins from McAllen. Instead, the children fell asleep on a lump of handbags and crumpled suit jackets on top of the mama and the papa's bed, dreaming of the contents of the big box. Finally, the 5th of January, and the boy Ruben and the girl Rosalinda could hardly sleep. All night, they whispered last-minute wishes. The boy thought perhaps if the big box held a bicycle, he would be the first to ride it since he was the oldest. This made his sister cry until the mama had to yell from her bedroom on the other side of the plastic curtains, "Be quiet, I'm going to give you each the stick," which sounds worse in Spanish than it does in English. Then no one said anything. After a very long time, long after they heard the mama's wheeze breathing and their papa's pipe snoring, the children closed their eyes and remembered nothing. The papa was already in the bathroom, coughing up the night before from his throat when the urracas began their clownish chirping. The boy Ruben awoke and shook his sister. The mama, frying the potatoes and beans for breakfast, nodded permission for the box to be opened. With a kitchen knife, the boy Ruben cut a careful edge along the top. The girl Rosalinda tore the Christmas wrapping with her fingernails. The papa and the mama lifted the cardboard flaps, and everyone peered inside to see what it was the brothers Travis had brought them on the day of the Three Kings. There were layers of bald newspaper packed on top. When these had been cleared away, the boy Ruben looked inside. The girl Rosalinda looked inside. The papa and the mama looked. This is what they saw. The complete Encyclopedia Britannica Junior, 24 volumes in red imitation leather with gold embossed letters beginning with volume 1, R. Bell, and ending with volume 24, Yale's Inn. The girl Rosalinda let out a sad cry as if her hair was going to be cut again. The boy Ruben pulled out volume 4, Dead Femme. There were many pictures and many words, but there were more words than pictures. The papa flipped through volume 22, but because he could not read English words, simply put the book back and grunted, "What can we do with this?" No one said anything, and shortly after, the screen door slammed. Only the mama knew what to do with the contents of the big box. She withdrew volumes 6, 7, and 8, marched off to the dinette set in the kitchen, placed 2 on Rosalinda's chair so she could better reach the table, and put 1 underneath the plant stand that danced. When the boy and the girl returned from school that day, they found the books stacked into squat pillars against one living room wall and a board placed on top. On this were arranged several plastic doilies and framed family photographs. The rest of the volumes the baby Gilberto was playing with, and he was already rubbing his sore gums along the corners of volume 14. The girl Rosalinda also grew interested in the books. She took out her colored pencils and painted blue on the lids of all the illustrations of women, and with a red pencil dipped in spit, she painted their lips and fingernails red, red. After a couple of days, when all the pictures of women had been colored in this manner, she began to cut out some of the prettier pictures and paste them on loose-leaf paper. One volume suffered from being exposed to the rain when the papa improvised a hat during a sudden shower. He forgot it on the hood of the car when he drove off. When the children came home from school, they set it on the porch to dry, but the pages puffed up and became so fat the book was impossible to close. Only the boy Ruben refused to touch the books. For several days, he avoided the principal because he didn't know what to say in case Mr. Travis were to ask how they were enjoying the Christmas present. On the Saturday after New Year's, the mama and the papa went into town for groceries and left the boy in charge of watching his sister and baby brother. The girl Rosalinda was stacking books into spiral staircases and making her paper dolls descend them in a fancy manner. Perhaps the boy Ruben would not have bothered to open the volume left on the kitchen table if he had not seen his mother wedge her name day corsage in its pages. On the page where the mama's carnation lay pressed between 2 pieces of Kleenex was a picture of a dog in a spaceship. "First dog in space," the caption said. The boy turned to another page and read where cashews came from, and then about the man who invented the guillotine. And then about Bengal tigers, and about clouds. All afternoon, the boy read, even after the mama and the papa came home, even after the sun set, until the mama said, "Time to sleep," and put the light out. In their bed, on the other side of the plastic curtain, the mama and the papa slept. Across from them in the crib slept the baby Gilberto. The girl Rosalinda slept on her end of the cot. But the boy Ruben watched the night sky turn from violet to blue to gray, and then from gray to blue to violet once again. That's a true story. One day I was sitting having a lunch in a nice restaurant in Dallas with my friend La Barbara and my compañero Ruben. And Ruben's a photographer, a very talented photographer, and Barbara's an essayist and columnist and a troublemaker, professional troublemaker. I really like her. And we were all thinking about how did we get to be able to sit in this restaurant and afford to pay for this meal? What little circumstance in our lives allowed us to be here? And Ruben told that story. Well, except he told it in three sentences. I added all the embellishments, you know, little details. But that is a true story. And I have to say, one of the things that allowed me, I gave my story over that lunch, and I said, I do have to repeat that story here. The reason why I'm here is thanks to the Chicago Public Library that allowed people like myself who could not afford to have books to borrow books. I didn't know you could buy a book till I was about 12. I had no idea. I'd never seen a bookstore or a book that didn't have a stamp on it that said return by or property of, you know. It wasn't, didn't belong to us. So thanks to Chicago Public School System and thanks to, not Chicago Public School System, Chicago Public Library. Chicago Public Library, Chicago Public School System, no thank you. But, you know, the thanks to museums like this one, the Field Museum, Science and Industry, and the free concerts in the park. So there was an advantage to growing up in Chicago, and it was that at that time when I was growing up, all those museums were free on Sundays, the day when working-class people have the day off on Sundays. I do have to repeat that and say that it's going to make a big difference to a generation that cannot afford to bring seven or eight children into a museum. But at that time when we were growing up, my mother brought us downtown. She would go listen to the concerts, and she'd say, leave me alone for an hour. And we'd run around and go to this museum, Field Museum, that Shedd Aquarium, all those museums, and especially the artwork in this museum, figure in my work a great deal. So thank you to my mother. Is she here yet? Oh, damn. Well, she's coming. Anyway, so maybe the people that run this museum will think about making the free day on a Sunday again. It makes a lot of difference. You know? Okay, I'm going to read. People wanted me to read something from House on Manga Street. And you know, I wrote this book in my 20s when I was working in Pilsen. And people think it's about Pilsen, but, you know, I never lived in Pilsen. I worked in Pilsen. I lived over on 63rd in Ashland. I lived over on Roosevelt Road in Leavitt. And later on Campbell and North Avenue, where I used the neighborhood of Humboldt Park. Not Wicker Park, Humboldt Park. Where, as my friend Carlos Cumpian mentioned when we were in Guadalajara last week, one weekend 50 people died last summer. That's more people than in Sarajevo, you know? And so I come from that neighborhood. And I'd like to, I was writing House on Manga Street during my 20s over my own exasperation about what I saw happening to my students. So I peopled my students. I put all of the people I knew in my 20s in the neighborhood from my past. So it's a composite of many Chicago neighborhoods. It's not Mango Avenue on the northwest side. The real street is Campbell, and the real house is over on the 1500 block on Campbell off of North and Western. I'll read one story and then leap over to something. Okay. All right, we'll read Hips because I get to sing. Okay. You know, I always wanted to be a singer. You know, if I wasn't a writer, I would like to be an opera singer or a flamenco dancer or a bandoneon player. You know, practical things. So I'm going to sing Hips because I like it. I have this dream one day of becoming a singer. Hips. I like coffee, I like tea, I like the boys and the boys like me. Yes, no, maybe so. Yes, no, maybe so. One day you wake up and they are there, ready and waiting like a new Buick with the keys in the ignition. Ready to take you where? They're good for holding a baby when you're cooking, Rachel says, turning the jump rope a little quicker. She has no imagination. You need them to dance, says Lucy. If you don't get them, you may turn into a man. Nanny says this, and she believes it. She is this way because of her age. That's right, I add, before Lucy or Rachel can make fun of her. She is stupid, all right, but she is my sister. But most important, hips are scientific, I say, repeating what Alicia already told me. It's the bones that let you know which skeleton was a man's when it was a man, and which a woman's. They bloom like roses, I continue, because it's obvious I'm the only one who can speak with any authority. I have science on my side. The bones just when they open, just like that. One day you might decide to have kids. And then, where are you going to put them? Got to have room. Bones got to give. But don't have too many, or your behind will spread. That's how it is, says Rachel, whose mama is as white as a boat, and we just laugh. What I'm saying is, who here is ready? You got to be able to know what to do with hips when you get them, I say, making it up as I go. You got to know how to walk with hips. Practice, you know? Like if half of you wanted to go one way and the other half the other. That's to lullaby it, Nanny says. That's to rock the baby asleep inside you. And then she begins singing, seashells, copper bells, Evie, Ivy, over. I'm about to tell her that's the dumbest thing I ever heard. But the more I think about it, you got to get the rhythm. And Lucy begins to dance. She has the idea, though she's having trouble keeping her end of the double dutch steady. It's got to be just so, I say. Not too fast and not too slow. Not too fast and not too slow. We slow the double circles down to a certain speed so Rachel, who has just jumped in, can practice shaking it. I want to shake like Hoochie Coochie, Lucy says. She is crazy. I want to move like Heebie Jeebie, I say, picking up on the cue. I want to be Tahiti or Merengue or Electricity or Tembleque. Yes, Tembleque, that's a good one. And then it's Rachel who starts it. Skip, skip, snake in your hips, wiggle around and break your lip. Lucy waits a minute before her turn. She is thinking. Then she begins. The waitress with the big fat hips, who pays the rent with taxi tips, says nobody in town will kiss her on the lips. Because she looks like Christopher Columbus. Yes, no, maybe so. Yes, no, maybe so. She misses on maybe so. I take a little while before my turn, take a breath and dive in. Some are skinny like chicken lips. Some are baggy like soggy band-aids after you get out of the bathtub. I don't care what kind I get, just as long as I get hips. Everybody getting into it now except Nanny, who is still humming, not a girl, not a boy, just a little baby. She's like that. When the two arcs open wide like jaws, Nanny jumps in across for me. The rope tick-ticking, the little gold earrings our mama gave her for her first Holy Communion bouncing. She is the color of a bar of naphtha laundry soap. She is like the little brown piece left at the end of the wash, the hard little bone, my sister. Her mouth opens. She begins. My mother and your mother were washing clothes. My mother punched your mother right in the nose. What color blood came out? Not that old song, I say. You gotta use your own song. Make it up, you know. But she doesn't get it or won't. It's hard to say which. The rope turning, turning, turning. Engine, engine number 9, running down Chicago line. If the train runs off the track, do you want your money back? Do you want your money back? Yes, no, maybe so. Yes, no, maybe so. I can tell Lucy and Rachel are disgusted, but they don't say anything because she's my sister. Yes, no, maybe so. Yes, no, maybe so. Nanny, I say. But she doesn't hear me. She is too many light years away. She is in a world we don't belong to anymore. Nanny, going, going. Y-E-S spells yes, and out you go. Okay. You know, I really do want to read poems, so I'm going to not read any more fiction, and I'd like to leap and have time to read the poems. I do want to say that this is a reissue of a book I wrote and finished in 1987. I wrote it during my 20s. It was published through a Chicana press that was born here in the Midwest, Third Woman Press, that is still existent. This is the paperback cover, and that's an earlier me. It's still available in paper, and I'd like to just mention that Third Woman Press, Norma Larcón, some of the people that were there helping us with the initial Carmen Abrego, Beatriz Batiquian, Diana Solis, and all of the people that helped us, Cindy, Carlos, Cumpian, Cindy Gallagher, all of these people, you know, helped to distribute, mention this book, and it's born here in the Midwest, but like a lot of us who did not get sustenance here in the Midwest, we moved on to other states that we thought might be kinder. I do want to read the preface so you understand where these poems came from as a bridge and as I move into the new work that I'm going to read from. But this is, you know, I did agree, yes, to republish this. And I have to say, when I saw this book, publishing a book of poems is kind of like having a baby. You think you're supposed to do it. You know, if you're a poet, you think you're supposed to publish your poems. If you're a woman, you think you're supposed to have a child. And once I published this book, I thought, oh, my God, what did I do? And I refused to let anyone see, or I refused to publish my poems after this book came out. And so people thought I wasn't writing poetry. Actually, I was writing it and throwing it under the bed like Emily Dickinson, and I think she was very smart to do that. But then, you know, they talked me into doing this hardback that it would help the small press. And my friend Terry Ibanez did the cover. She's a Chicana artist from San Antonio, and I'm very, very happy with the edition that they've done. I said, yes, you can publish it, but only if I can write a preface. It was very hard to write that preface, and I tried rewriting it several times. It didn't work. Finally, I finished it in Greece, in the island where I finished House on Mongo Street, and this is the preface. It has an epigraph. One is by Mary Cassatt, and I don't think I need to explain who she is, and the second epigraph is by Cantinflas, and he's a very, very popular Mexican comedian. Preface. I can live alone, and I love to work. Mary Cassatt. Allí está el detalle. Cantinflas. Roughly translated, there's the rub. Gentlemen, ladies, if you please, these are my wicked poems from when? The girl grief decade. My wicked nun year, so to speak. I sinned. Not in the white woman way, not as Simone voyeuring the pretty slum city on a golden arm, and no, not wicked like the captain of the bad boy blood, that Hollywood hoodlum who boozed and floozed it up, hell-bent on self-destruction, not me. Well, not much. Tell me, how does a woman who, a woman like me, daughter of a daddy with a hammer and blistered feet he'd dip into a washtub while he ate his dinner. A woman with no birthright in the matter. What does a woman inherit that tells her how to go? My first felony, I took up with poetry. For this penalty, the rice burned. Mother warned I'd never wife. Wife? A woman like me, whose choice was rolling pin or factory. An absurd vice, this wicked, wanton writer's life. I chucked the life my father'd plucked for me, leapt into the salamander fire. A girl who'd never roamed beyond her father's rooster eye, winched the door with poetry and fled for good. And grieved I'd gone when I was so alone. In my kitchen in the thin hour, a calendar Cassatt chanted, repeat after me, I can live alone and I love to. What a crock. Each week the ritual grief, that decade of the knuckled knocks. I took the crooked route and liked my badness. Played at mistress, tattooed an ass, lapped up my happiness from a glass. It was something at least. I hadn't a clue. What does a woman willing to invent herself at 22 or 29 do? A woman with no who nor how. And how was I to know what was unwise? I wanted to be writer. I wanted to be happy. What's that at 20 or 29? Love, baby, husband, the works. The big palookas of life, wanting and not wanting. Take your hands off me. I left my father's house before the brothers, vagabond of the globe like a rich white girl. Got a flat. I paid for it. I kept it clean. Sometimes the silence frightened me. Sometimes the silence blessed me. It would come get me late at night, open like a window, hungry for my life. I wrote when I was sad, the flat cold, when there was no love, new, old, to distract me. No six brothers with their Fellini racket. No mother, father with their wives. I told you. I tell you. These are the pearls from that 10-year itch. My jewels, my colicky kids who fussed and kept me up the wicked nights when all I wanted was with nothing in the text to tell me. But that was then, the who I was who would become the who I am. These poems are from that hobbled when. Okay. When I was going to school in Iowa, it took me a long time to figure out why I felt so strange there. And once I figured it out, I decided I was going to write an anti-poem. Anti-poem and create my anti-poetics. Because, you know, before I'd been there, I thought that everyone had a right to be an artist. I didn't realize that a lot of people have lots of help in becoming an artist. And that they have connections or powerful, influential friends that are friends of their mother and father or trust funds or, you know, and it seemed quite remarkable that I'd even gotten that far. So I decided to write a kind of anti-Iowa poem and anti-Iowa poetics. And in order to create that kind of poetics, I looked at writers like Luis Vales Matos, you know, Puerto Rican poet, other writers, Chicago writers like Gwendolyn Brooks and Carl Sandburg and other people that would sustain me during that hard period. And I wrote this poem because, you know, everyone in Iowa thought they were experts on everything. And it was nice to be able to be an expert on something if I wrote about streets of Chicago. And this one's called South Sangamon. We wake up and it's him banging and banging, and the doorknob rattling open up. His drunk cussing, her name all over the hallway, and my name mixed in. He yelling from the other side, open! And she yelling from this side, no! A long time of this, and we saying nothing, just hoping he'd get tired and go. Then the whole door shakes, like his big foot meant to break it. Then quiet. So we figured he'd gone. That day he punched her belly, the whole neighborhood watching. That was Tuesday, so this time we lock it. And just when we got those kids quiet, and me, I shut my eyes again, she laughing, her cigarette lit. Just then, the big rock comes in. Okay. Curtains. You know, one thing that I think distinguishes us in class is, you know, you can always tell if people have a lot of money because they don't have any curtains because they're not ashamed of what they own. And people that don't have a lot of things, that usually as soon as nightfall comes, they close their curtains. And this poem is about Chicago. Curtains. Rich people don't need them. Poor people tie theirs into fist or draw them tight as modest brides up to the neck. Inside they hide bright walls, turquoise or lipstick pink, good colors in another country. Here they can't make you forget the dinette set that isn't paid for, floorboards the landlord needs to fix, raw wood, linoleum roses, the what you wanted but didn't get. I'm going to jump and read some new poems. You know, when I was living in Chicago, if we wanted a writer's workshop, we made one. And like I said, you know, Carmen Abrego and Diana Solis, Beatriz Batiquian, Carlos Compián, Cindy Gallagher, were all part of a gallery called Galería Quique that we did in my brother's apartment because we thought it was a perfect space to hold a monthly arts event. So for about a year and a half, we had this series called Galería Quique where we would feature artists that weren't going to be featured here or in down over in the artist community on the other side of the river. And we also featured writers. And after we'd finished these monthly events that we did all through our own efforts with no grant from anyone, we would go out and have something to eat, you know, 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock in the morning, because that's when you really needed some emergency tacos. And those, you know, 7 poets, Beatriz Batiquian, myself, Carlos Cortez, Carlos Compián, Cindy Gallagher, Margie López Castro, Raul Niño, we worked together to make a little chapbook of our own poems called Emergency Tacos. And it's a book that's out of print, but I'd like to read from it. This is called Original Sin, and it's a true story. Before Mexicana flight number 729 en route to Mexico City departs from San Antonio International Airport, I buy a 69-cent disposable razor at the gift shop because I forgot in Mexico they don't like hair under your arms, only on your legs, and plan to shave before landing, but the stewardess handing out declaration forms has given me the wrong one, assuming I'm Mexican, but I am, and I have to run up the aisle and ask for a U.S. citizen form instead because I'm, well, how do I explain? Except before you know it, we're already crossing the volcanoes and descending into the valley of Mexico City, and I have to rush to the back where the plane drops too quickly, as if the pilot's in a hurry to get home, and into the little airplane bathroom where lots of couples want to coitus, fantasize us, but I only want to get rid of my underarm hair quick before the plane touches down in the land of Los Nopales, disregarding lights blinking, kindly return to your seat and fasten your seatbelt, all in Spanish, of course, just in time for flight number 729 to deposit me finally into the arms of a waiting Mexican kin on my father's side of the family, where I open my arms wide, armpits clean as a newborn soul without original sin, and embrace them like the good girl my father would have them believe I am. I want to read some new poems, you know, because I see Wicked Ways, and it's a true testament of my 20s, but it's a sad book. And, you know, I'm not sad anymore. I'm going to be 38 on Sunday. I'm feeling very powerful. And it's not true that when you get older for women, you know, that it's disastrous. You get better. It's great. I'm going to celebrate Sunday at the Chameleon Productions of over at the Edgewater Theater. Is that the name of it? Their production of The House on Manga Street. Very good. I'm so proud of them. I'd like to thank Amy Ludwig and all of this, the cast, for doing such a beautiful job with my book. But I'd like to read some new poems. As I said, one of my Tejana girlfriends did the cover of this. That's La Terry Bañez. And Terry Bañez was real worried when she turned 31 because she thought, you know, she believed all the propaganda that when you get older, it's terrible for women. That's not true. So I wrote this poem for her, and this was for her 31st birthday. This is called Black Lace Bra Kind of Woman. Para la mujer de fuerza, La Terry, who today is 31, 6 de julio, 1990, San Antonio. Wachale, she's a black lace bra kind of woman, the kind who serves up suicide with every kamikaze poured in the neon blue of evening. A tease and a twirl. I've seen that two-step girl in action. I've gambled bad odds and sat shotgun when she rambled her 59 Pontiac between the blurred lines dividing sense and senselessness. Ruin your clothes, she will. Get you home way after hours. Drive her 59, 75 on 35 like there is no tomorrow. Woman zydecoing into her own decade. 30 years pleated behind her like the wail of a San Antonio accordion. And now, the good times are coming. Girl, I tell you, the good times are here. I want to read another poem for Las Girlfriends. You know, all the women I hang out with, including myself, there's always some bar or club we're not welcome at that we either got kicked out or we were asked never to come back. I don't know why, but it's all these women I know. So I decided to write a poem about them. This is called Last Girlfriend. Tip the barmaid in tight jeans. She's my friend. Been to hell and back again. I've been there too. Girlfriend, I believe in Gandhi. But some nights nothing says it quite precise like a lone star cracked on someone's head. Last week in this same bar, kicked a cowboy in the butt who made a grab for Terry's ass. How do I explain? It was all of Texas I was kicking, and all our asses on the line. At Taco Land, cat flamencoing crazy circles round the pool player with the furry tongue. A warpath of sorts for every wrong ever wronged us. And Terry here has her own history. A bar down the street she can't go in, and one downtown. Me, a French cafe in Austin, where they don't say entrez-vous. Little Rose of San Antonio is the queen bee of Kicknalga. When you go out with her, don't wear your good clothes. But the best story is La Barbara, who runs for the biggest kitchen knife in the house every badass domestic quarrel. Points it towards her own heart like some Aztec priestess gone loca. Me mato! I tell you, nights like these, something bubbles from the tips of our pointy boots to the top of our coyote yowl. Y'all wicked mean, a voice at the bar claims. Nah, not mean. Shit. Been to hell and back again. Girl, me too. Okay, I gotta hurry up here. I wanna read this poem called Mexicans in France. There are, you know, there are not many, but there are some. And I happen to be there. And this is a true story, so I would like to read this for you. Mexicans in France. He says he likes Mexico, especially all that history. That's what I understand, although my French is not that good. And wants to talk about U.S. racism. It's not often he meets Mexicans in the south of France. He remembers a Mexican Marlon Brando once on French TV. How in Westerns, the Mexicans are always the bad guys. And is it true all Mexicans carry knives? I laugh. Lucky for you, I'm not carrying my knife today. He laughs too. I think the knife you carry is abstract. Okay, I want to kind of finish up here. I'm going to read two poems. You know, I tried to, not read just this one. Yeah. There's a poem coming out January 1st in the New York Times, and they didn't take the one I wanted them to take, because the op-ed page is going to do a whole page of poetry this year. So get January 1st. I've got a poem in there. But, you know, my agent said, well, do you have any New Year's poems? And I said, well, not really. Do you have any poems about renewal, about being new again? I said, yeah, send them this one, but they didn't like it. And it, maybe the title will tell you why. I'll read this one and then finish up with one other one. I am so in love, I grow a new hymen. I like it. They weren't ready for it. I like it. Okay. I want to read my new love poem because I'm so in love, I just feel like this. You know, sometimes you meet somebody and you know they're trouble, but too bad, too late. I am so in love, I grow a new hymen. Terrorist of the last decade, anarchist who fled with my heart thudding on the back bumper of a flatbed truck, Nelson Algren impersonators, Joe Hill detonators, los más chingones de los más chingones, politically correct Marxist tourist voyeurs, Olympic gold, silver, bronze, love triathlons, and several blue ribbon runner-ups to boot, forgot, forgotten, forget, past tense and no regrets. No doubt, your via. and I'm Pershing's Dizzy Troops. No doubt I'm Eucalyptus, and you a California conflagration. No doubt you're Eucharist, Euclidean geometry, World War II's Gibraltar Strait, the Chinese traders of Guangzhou, Zapatistas breakfasting at Sanborn's, Sassoferrato's cobalt blue, Museo Poldi Pasoli's insurance rate, Gaudi's hammer against porcelain plates. Daddy, I don't give a good goddamn. I don't give a good goddamn. Okay.